It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry attempts to trumpet Africa's success story even as he mediates deadly conflicts. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. 7 of the world's 10 fastest-growing economies are in Africa, and GDP is expected to rise 6% per year in the next decade. HIV infections are down nearly 40% in sub-Saharan Africa, and malaria deaths among children have declined 50%. Child mortality rates are also falling, and life expectancy is decreasing. Secretary Kerry outlined these statistics in an opinion editorial for The Washington Post just prior to his swing through Ethiopia, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola. However, on that trip, he primarily dealt with crises. He managed to persuade South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar to hold direct peace talks for the first time since months of political and ethnic violence have caused thousands of deaths and driven more than 1.1 million people from their homes. Then, on the eve of the World Economic Forum in Abuja, Nigeria, meant to showcase Africa's economic prowess and potential, many countries pledged support to the Nigerian government in its hunt for the 276 schoolgirls kidnapped by the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. This high-profile act of terror and violence has brought renewed focus on the need for a comprehensive strategy to defeat Boko Haram. Washington is sending a team of U.S. military advisors to help with communications, logistics, and intelligence. Well, for more on Secretary Kerry's visit to the continent and attempts to broker the South Sudan conflict and combat Boko Haram in Nigeria, we turn to two distinguished analysts and frequent commentators at these microphones. Ambassador David Shin is former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso. He's currently professor of international affairs at George Washington University. He blogs at the official blog of Ambassador David H. Shin. And Richard Downey, he's deputy director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. That's a think tank here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, Ambassador Shin, let me start with you. Let's do sort of an overview of Secretary Kerry's trip. What do you think he achieved, particularly with regard to sanctions that the U.S. imposed on some individuals in South Sudan, and of course, this promise to help Nigeria in combating Boko Haram?
Well, Secretary Kerry visited Ethiopia, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Angola. In terms of the sanctions that were levied against two persons in South Sudan, quite frankly, they're really just symbolic. There were two commanders, one with the government, one with the rebel forces, whose assets, if there are any in the United States, would be prohibited from their use. And it's questionable whether they even have any assets in the United States. So that, in and of itself, is not going to have any impact on the situation. But it does send a signal that there could be more to come. And that's where sanctions could play something of a useful role. In terms of the support for the Nigerian government in dealing with Boko Haram, it's a little unclear at this point where the some 300 girls are. My guess is they're widely dispersed around either northern Nigeria, possibly even in neighboring Cameroon or Niger or even Chad. And if that is the case, it's going to be very difficult to track them down. The United States, of course, has the ability to provide some intelligence support, forensic evidence support, certainly better communications. This is all useful and good. And other countries are also offering support. But if these girls are as dispersed as I suspect they are, it's going to be exceedingly hard to track them all down and bring them back safely.
Turning to you, Richard Downey, for your take on these particular issues and what you think Secretary Kerry achieved on his recent trip to Africa.
Well, the trip was previewed as being a very broad-ranging one, focusing not only on security issues, but democracy, good governance, and the trade and investment, the upside of the Africa story right now. In the end, it became a trip, at least the headlines generated from the trip, focused on the security issues. I suppose if there are any big takeaways, it was Secretary Kerry's efforts to get the two main protagonists in the South Sudan civil war to agree to attend face-to-face talks for the first time since the conflict broke out. He extracted a promise from President Kiir, a half-hearted semi-commitment from his rival Riek Machar. But with follow-up the following week from the UN Secretary General, it seems that those talks have been taking place. In terms of the economic side, it was a focus of Secretary Kerry's in three of the four countries he visited. Not much in the way of hard and fast results, but I think the symbolism of the trip shows that the United States is trying to raise Africa up the agenda, and these sorts of high-level engagements are useful, and they also preview the forthcoming Africa Leaders Summit, which will take place here in Washington in early August with the president himself.
Indeed. We'll get to that later in the program. Back to you, Ambassador Shin, and let's turn to South Sudan. You have been following that part of Africa. Do you think that conditions are in place for these talks to be successful, to put an end to this horrifying violence that has racked South Sudan as a result of this power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar? What are your expectations?
Well, I would like to be pleasantly surprised that conditions are in place to achieve some real success with these talks. The fact that the talks are occurring is a positive sign. That's clear. But the conditions for any real success coming out of them, I think, are highly questionable. The problems are so deep at the moment between particularly the leaderships of the two groups, and there really are other groups than just those two who are involved in this, and also between the ethnic groups involved, particularly the Dinka and the Nuer, that the idea of achieving any kind of early end to the conflict, I think, may be wishful thinking. It's absolutely essential to try and to begin the process, but there have been other attempts earlier on where there was an agreement to have a ceasefire, for example. It did not hold. It broke down almost immediately. And I'm just not sure that I see the willingness to proceed along a peaceful path at this moment. And it's even questionable whether the two leaders have control over all of the people who are out there engaged in the fighting at the moment. I'm not sure they do.
Turning to you, Richard Downey, for your thoughts with respect to if conditions are in place. It's great that these two men are meeting, but to what extent do they have control? And what about the forthcoming predictions of famine and these other urgent matters that need to be taken into consideration?
I'm afraid I share Ambassador Shin's skepticism about how much these talks will achieve, although they're obviously a welcome development. I think the focus has to be on the short term right now, and that would involve having a cessation of hostilities on the ground that actually holds and is respected by both sides and their many followers or semi-attached militias. And it's true, they have very little control over many of those actors in the field. The second big issue is securing humanitarian access to communities that have been affected and displaced by the violence. And again, that's unfortunately, whatever commitments we get from the two leaders, it's going to be down to on-the-ground negotiations with individual militia leaders. So there are short-term goals that must be secured, but there's a much longer-term, much more tricky fix that has to be found to really change the nature of governance in South Sudan, and that's an issue that's probably beyond the negotiators right now.
One more question to you, Ambassador Shin, on this particular issue. Of course, the United States was very instrumental in helping achieve independence for South Sudan. What responsibility does the United States have in taking ownership or helping to bring about a cessation of hostilities and leading the government on a path to stability and peace?
Well, I think the United States does have considerable responsibility. It clearly played one of the leading roles in the creation of the new state of South Sudan. So it cannot at this time back away. And to its credit, it's not. I think the fact that Secretary Kerry is investing as much time as he is in this, and it's my understanding there have been occasional calls directly from President Obama to key leaders involved in the Sudan conflict. So there is an effort by the United States to play a meaningful role in this, and rightfully so. The problem is, as Richard suggested, it really requires not just a ceasefire and an end to the conflict, but probably going back to basics and coming up with perhaps even a new structure for how one governs South Sudan. The Constitution of South Sudan is a wonderful document. I've read it, and it sounds great. But unfortunately, it's not being observed, and it probably can't be observed because the South Sudanese don't have the entire capacity to implement everything in the Constitution. And there may be elements of that Constitution that have to be reconfigured in order to deal with all of the varying opinions that you have in the country.
Richard Downey, anything to add or subtract to the U.S. role? And what about the East African bloc, IGAD? How come they have been unsuccessful thus far in bringing these parties together and ceasing the hostilities?
Well, it's a tough ask for IGAD to secure a breakthrough in ending these hostilities, but I think it's important that the international community rallies around IGAD as it tries to continue that effort. The countries around South Sudan have a lot invested in this crisis. Some of them indeed have their own military forces in action in the field as well, which has complicated matters, but they've also received the lion's share of the refugees that have fled the country. So, of course, a stable South Sudan is in their best interest, and it's therefore right, I think, that they retain the leadership in trying to resolve this situation with support from the United States and other important actors as well.
Let's turn to the Nigerian crisis with the abduction of these schoolgirls by Boko Haram. Ambassador Shin, we've been talking about Boko Haram on this program for several years now. And of course, now their actions have grabbed headlines around the world. Why has Nigeria been unable to properly address this problem? We know that there are other factors, economic as well as counterterrorism. And they have also been reluctant to accept U.S. aid and advice in the past with respect to combating Boko Haram. How do you think this action may change that calculus?
Well, I think it's important to understand that Boko Haram dates back to 2002 under a then charismatic Islamic leader in northern Nigeria. He was attacked by government forces in 2009. That tended to radicalize the organization, almost disappeared very briefly, but then came back with a vengeance in a very radical form. In 2010, the United States put it on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations. And ever since then, it has been an organization that has engaged in just nihilistic kind of activity that is really aimed at anything that will help destroy Western influence in northern Nigeria. So they have done absolutely horrific acts for several years now. The abduction of the 300 or so schoolgirls is just one in a long string of really horrible activities that Boko Haram has engaged in. And unfortunately, what I think this has done in terms of the government of Nigeria is to sort of make it numb to what's going on. They've encountered so much of this that it's sort of one more incident for them, and as a result, they did not react as quickly and as effectively as they might have to this incident. And I think there's a reluctance to accept American and other support because just nationalistic feelings. It's, you know, we can do this ourselves. It's our problem. We'll grapple with it. Now it's gotten totally out of hand, and they're willing to accept outside support. But now it's very late to be engaging and with outside support when the incident has gone as far as it has.
Very, very true. Turning to you, Richard Downey, to talk more about this particular incident and to what extent U.S. and outside help can actually help the government recover these girls, but also to what extent it speaks to this problem and how the calculus will change on the part of the Nigerian government and military. There's an outpouring of outrage now, which we had not seen before by Nigerians, the mothers and others. To what extent is this a game changer now?
Well, I think it's heaped significant embarrassment on the government in Abuja that essentially their inactivity in responding to this crisis has been exposed to the wider world. And at a time when they're entering a critical election campaign, when Abuja is hosting the World Economic Forum, it's frankly embarrassing for Nigeria to be attracting such negative headlines. In terms of what the international community can do, I agree again with Ambassador Shin. It's fairly limited. You know, ultimately, the responsibility for dealing with this crisis will lie at the door of the Nigerians themselves. And, you know, I think there's a frustration, a feeling that the ruling elite, the political class in Abuja, have not been sufficiently invested in this crisis from the start. The northeast of Nigeria, where the vast majority of Boko Haram attacks have taken place, is a sort of economic backwater of Nigeria. It's 500 miles plus from the capital, and it actually also happens to be an opposition stronghold as well. And so for many reasons, I think there's a feeling that the government has not been sufficiently invested in this crisis. The Nigerian military response has intensified in the past year. There was a state of emergency was declared in the three worst affected states. The Nigerians have gone in very, very hard, and that really has tended to be counterproductive. It's alienated further communities there. There have been indiscriminate killings and human rights abuses. So I think the Nigerians need to focus, and this is advice that they're receiving from the Americans, they need to focus on a more well-rounded strategy that goes beyond a purely security approach to this crisis.
And do you think that the Nigerian government now finally may be receptive to that type of advice? And would it be willing to change, adapt its tactics and strategy vis-a-vis Boko Haram?
I think the lessons have been taken on board and have been in recent months, actually. You had a shake-up of the security services in Nigeria in terms of personnel and structure, and an encouraging speech by the new National Security Advisor that talks about the need to combine the military response with a softer approach that tries to address some of the root causes and grievances of people in the northeast. So those are encouraging signs, but they need follow through. And that's often where Nigerian state falls down, in the follow up and the follow through.
Well, we'll be following this story in Nigeria in the weeks and months ahead on separate programs. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador David Shin, former U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso. He's currently Professor of International Affairs at George Washington University. And Richard Downey, from whom you just heard, he's Deputy Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a think tank here in Washington. And we're talking about U.S. Secretary of State Kerry's recent trip to Africa and how Washington and the international community can staunch the bloodshed in South Sudan and aid Nigeria in combating Boko Haram. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And as always, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback to encounter@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Well, back to you, Ambassador Shin, and let's move on to other topics on Secretary Kerry's agenda in Africa. He also visited the DRC. He met with President Joseph Kabila and encouraged Kabila to disarm the so-called FDLR. This is, the militia, the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, that perpetrated the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. Secretary Kerry also pledged tens of millions of dollars for elections. So what are your takeaways from this visit in DRC?
Well, to me, the most important takeaway to the visit in the DRC was the emphasis on observing term limits, in this case with Joseph Kabila, who is the current president. And there are rumors circulating that perhaps the president of the DRC would like to adjust things such that term limits don't have to apply. But it goes beyond the Democratic Republic of the Congo. There's been, unfortunately, a history of African leaders who have found ways to work around term limits. And I think this is one of the most egregious governance offenses on the continent, to continue to do that when you have leaders who have been in power for 15, 20, 25 years, and in theory have term limits in their constitution, but they find workarounds. This does not send the kind of signal that I think the people of these countries want to see. So I was encouraged that he spoke out on the issue of term limits and applied it more widely to upcoming elections in other African countries where it also may be a problem. And I think it's high time that there be an emphasis on that issue.
Turning to you, Richard Downey, what is your takeaway from this visit with Joseph Kabila, and would you characterize it as a success?
The jury's out on whether this trip will turn out to be a success in the Congo context, but the term limit issue was important. Kabila, at the time of the last election, used an excuse that he didn't have enough money to fund the electoral process as a reason to scrap the second round runoff, and that had the effect of tilting the field in his favor quite decisively. So the promise of support of funding for the electoral process removes that excuse in the future. Also important, I think, is that Congolese have the chance to have local elections, which have never taken place in the post-independence history. One of the problems of governance in the Congo has been an over-centralized and devolving power and authority into the regions is going to be an important aspect of this as well. Secretary Kerry arrived in DRC on the back of some quite positive progress in dealing with the insecurity in the east of the country. The M23 rebels are defeated and peace agreement was reached. But now it's a case of follow through in dealing with the other armed groups and also grappling with this issue of what to do with these former M23 fighters. In previous agreements, peace agreements in the Congo, the former militias have just been subsumed into the national military and almost rewarded for their rebellion. Well, this can't happen this time, and that was one of the messages that Secretary Kerry was trying to pass on to not only the Congolese, but the Rwandans and other neighbours who've been embroiled in these conflicts for the past 20-odd years.
All right, we'll have to see to what extent Kabila can, in fact, help disarm some of these other militias and, of course, respect these term limits. But moving on to Angola, Ambassador Shin, speaking of term limits, if I recall, President José Eduardo dos Santos has been in power for many, many years now.
He has. I must confess, I'm not sure whether they have term limits in the Angolan constitution. They may not. So technically, I think he may be okay legally.
I gotcha. But nonetheless, you know, Secretary Kerry was singing the praises of Angola, its role in providing regional security in the Great Lakes region and leading on the CAR, Central African Republic, crisis. How do you read the U.S.-Angolan bilateral relationship?
U.S. policy is not always 100% consistent from one country to another, first off. There tends to be shades of gray going on with certain countries, and Angola may be one of them. I think in the case of Angola, the primary interest is simply the fact that the United States is Angola's largest trading partner. It's often thought that that might be China, but who I'm sure is number two in the case of Angola. But we import so much oil still from Angola that we are the largest trading partner. And you have major American companies engaged in Angola, like Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, General Electric. So it's the trade and the investment component of Secretary Kerry's trip to Africa that I think was the loud and clear message in Angola, in addition to trying to bring Angola into the Great Lakes issue in a positive way, to make them a positive player in any of the political security issues in the Great Lakes. The United States obviously has longstanding and important relations with Angola. It's an important partner of the United States, but there clearly are some issues of governance, too.
No question. There are governance issues in that country. But it is a very rich oil, a diamond-rich country, Richard Downey. And as Ambassador Shin said, we have this strong relationship. How do you see Angola's role in the region? Do you see it as positive, whether in the Great Lakes or CAR? Do you see them taking on more responsibility for regional security?
Yeah, it's somewhat ironic that on a trip where governance was a fairly consistent theme, that it was less noticeable in Angola, which actually has Africa's longest-serving head of state. But I think Angola and the U.S. Understands this is a rising power, regional power in southern and central Africa. President Dos Santos has played a constructive role more recently in the Great Lakes as chairman of this ICGLR group, which is made up of the Great Lakes countries. There's also, I think, a U.S. desire to strengthen the bilateral relationship. There's been a history of reticence on the Angolan side, dates back, of course, to the Civil War period, where the U.S. backed the wrong side in that war. The opponents, the MPLA, are now in power, and I think many of the leadership there are still reluctant to fully embrace the United States because of that troubled history. Clearly there are economic ties which should be strengthened. Angola has a very strong military and has the potential to play a very constructive role in peacekeeping and security issues in the broader Africa region.
In the few minutes we have left, back to you, Ambassador Shin. Quickly, while Secretary Kerry was in Africa, President Obama met with the Djiboutian president here in Washington, and they signed a new 10-year lease on that military base. Camp Le Monnier houses 4,000 U.S. soldiers, and it's a major staging area for attacks against terrorists in Yemen and Somalia. How do you read the significance of this agreement?
Clearly, the United States has concluded that that's an important facility for combating terrorism in Yemen and throughout East Africa and the Horn of Africa. That 10-year agreement is, as I recall, a $62 million payment annually over the next 2 years, which is, I think, about double what the previous rent was on the facility. And as you indicated, at 4,000, that's about double the number of personnel who were there, say, 5 years ago or so. So the importance of that facility is clear in the eyes of the U.S. military. It also includes a drone operation. And as far as I know, it's the only drone operation in the region that actually has a missile attack capacity. All of the other drone operations the U.S. has anywhere, either in Africa or in the Seychelles offshore, are surveillance only. And this one is one that I believe is used from time to time, particularly in Yemen. So it's considered to be an important facility.
Now, Richard Downey, it's the only permanent U.S. military base in Africa. Anything to add or subtract to the importance of this agreement and the role this military base plays in regional security in the Horn?
It plays a very important role. It is the only permanent U.S. base. There are the U.S. military footprint in Africa has expanded somewhat, but remains relatively small. And this is the only serious concentration of U.S. power on and boots on the ground, as it were, in Africa. And so securing this agreement was clearly very important to the United States and obviously has trumped other issues in the bilateral relationship. The Djiboutian president is another abuser of term limits. So I doubt that was part of the conversation with President Obama.
Well, there's also human trafficking involved, but those are topics for another program. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador David Shin, former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, and Richard Downey, deputy director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thanks. You're welcome, Carol.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Glenn Von Calio, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.